This is Wide Margins Episode 4, Bokum. This episode begins a series on the Book of Judges, something that I've wanted to do ever since I started thinking about this podcast. I've taught the Book of Judges in church several times, portions of it. One time I did a sermon series on it very early on in my years as a preacher, but I've always found it difficult to teach it thoroughly. There are just some things in this book that are a little, may I say, inappropriate for worship. I say that very carefully. Even in Bible class, there would be some pretty sticky things that we get into. And so, you know, what most preachers do and what I've done through the years is talk about some of our favorite areas of the book. You know, we talk about Gideon, we talk about Deborah, we talk about Samson, we look at the key verses and we get, you know, the important concepts out, but we don't thoroughly cover the book. And so what I like about the podcast is I can cover the book thoroughly, and if you don't like it, you can skip the episodes, or you can just turn me off, or you can unsubscribe, whatever you want to do. You can trash me, leave a negative review on iTunes. You can do whatever you want to do, and I can do what I want to do, which is to dig really deep into this book and get to the heart of the message that God wants us to hear. And so I'm going to introduce the book in this episode, and then however long it takes, however many episodes required, I'm going to thoroughly cover everything in here, all of the, you know, popular stuff that people talk about, and then all of the weird stuff, and all of the, monstrous stuff that you find in this book, because what you're going to see is what happens to a people that forgets God and isn't grateful for God and doesn't teach their children about His good works on their behalf. What happens is a downward spiral that is self-destructive. And what happened to Israel then can certainly happen to the church today, no doubt about it, which makes this a very important book, not just to kind of, you know, lead us up to the days of Samuel, Saul, David, and Solomon, but, you know, not just for the history and the background, but for a spiritual lesson as well. Now, let me start by, you know, talking about the shape of God's people, God's nation of Israel at this time. I think a lot of Bible students approach the book of Judges with the wrong idea in their head about what Israel looked like. They think of Israel always as the Israel of the days of David and Solomon, with Jerusalem as the capital, maybe with the temple there in Jerusalem, all of the tribes unified, much like the United States of America. And that is very far from the true picture of what Israel was like in the days of the judges. It wasn't anything like the United States of America is today. The 12 tribes were not comparable to the 50 states of the USA, just not anything like it at all. You'll have to remember, it has only been a little time since Moses has led Israel in the wilderness wanderings up to the Jordan River, preparing them to conquer Canaan, the promised land, dying and turning it over to Joshua, his successor. It's only been a little time since Joshua led them to Jericho and then all of the other victories that they had that you can read about in the book of Joshua. It's only been a little bit of time since they began to settle the land as tribes, as individual tribes. So what you have is no central government. You have a loose confederation of 12 tribes that sometimes get along together and work together, and then sometimes battle each other in civil war. That explains a lot of what you find in the book of Judges. And it also explains the organization of the book. The book of Judges covers a time period of about 300 to 350 years. But if you go through the book and you add up the years, for example, of peace and oppression that are listed in the book, you come up with something like 410 years. And this isn't an error, a mathematical error, or anything like that on the part of the author. what it is it, this, the stories in this book are overlapping in places. So maybe while Deborah, and this may be a bad example, but just off the top of my head, while Deborah and Barak are leading their tribes to victory in one place, Gideon may have been working with others in another place at the same time. You can't look at this as chronological in its organization. It's not that at all. The organization of the book of Judges instead is actually cyclical. And there's only, I may be wrong, but there's only one other book in the Bible that I can think of that's organized in a cyclical manner like the book of Judges, and that would be the book of Revelation. You know, when you read the book of Revelation, you might notice that the world keeps coming to an end, or Judgment Day keeps occurring, or heaven keeps popping up. In fact, that you know, end time apocalyptic event occurs seven times. And, you know, seven is a very important number in Bible study. It you know, is connected to divine perfection. And so that can't be an accident that John, who had seven miracles in the Gospel of John and seven I Am statements of Jesus in the Gospel of John, wrote the book of Revelation in seven cycles. Well, I don't think it's any mistake that you find seven cycles in the book of Judges. In Judges, you'll find, and we'll talk about the cycles a little bit later, but for just this introduction part, in the book of Judges, you'll find seven apostasies, seven oppressions, seven cries to God, and seven deliverances. All these are in a cycle. So seven times Israel goes through that cycle, and it repeats itself. And that is an illustration of what happens when you fail to have the kind of leadership you need to have. After Joshua, no one rose up to continue to pick up the mantle of Joshua and lead them further along in the direction that they should go. However, you did have these judges. Now, here's another misconception we often have when we think of judges. We think of the, you know, the person in the black robes coming into the courtroom for strictly judicial reasons to rule over a court or something like that. That's because in our world, that's what a judge is. But back then, judges had broader responsibilities. They were, I think, first and foremost, military commanders. And then they were also prophets. They were judges, of course, leaders, teachers, spiritual deliverers. They covered all of that ground, but all of them seemed to have a military function, including even Deborah to some extent, who was working alongside Barak, who was definitely a military commander. So these were the judges, and you'll see more than seven of them, but some of them worked in pairs so that you have, you know, a pair or a single judge over these seven cycles as the book is organized. Now, let's get into chapter 1. The first verse of chapter 1 says that these events are set after the death of Joshua. And just as the death of Moses was a pivotal time in Israel, the death of Joshua was also a pivotal time in Israel. It was a time in which the people were going to have to decide who they were. Were they going to follow God, or were they going to follow in their own way? And that's how the book begins. After Joshua's death, it says that the people of Israel inquired of the Lord. Now, that phrase is very interesting because it suggests possibly the use of these mysterious, I don't know if they were jewels or stones, the Urim and the Thummim, that were contained in the breastplate of the priest, the ephod of the priest. I'm not exactly sure what they did. Most scholars believe that these stones would give an answer of yes or no to questions that the people had for the Lord. So I know it doesn't spell that out for us, but the language there suggests that they were using the ephod in that manner to ask the Lord who first should go up against the Canaanites to do battle. Now, the Lord says something very interesting, verse 2. and it takes us back to language that was used when Joshua was taking the reins of the nation before he died. In verse 2, the Lord says, "Judah shall go up." So he's talking about the tribe of Judah. "Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand." So the Lord's saying, I have already given the land of Canaan, the promised land, to Israel. Now, some of you may be thinking, why in the world are we talking about this now? Didn't Israel settle the land in the days of Joshua? Not quite. In the first half of the book of Joshua, there's one successful battle after another. But then in the second half, you see a pattern of incompletion. You know, they would win a battle, but they would not drive out all the inhabitants of the land. And they lived as neighbors with the inhabitants of the land. And the mandate that the Lord had given to them was that they were to drive out all the people from the land so that they could be God's holy nation. That had not yet been done, so here they are, after the days of Joshua, working to complete the task the Lord had given them to take the land that had already been given to them. Now, as I said, this is a statement similar to something said early in Joshua's rule of the people. If you go back to Joshua chapter 6, verse 2, prior to the battle with Jericho, the Lord said this to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and mighty men of valor." And then he starts giving the instructions that, you know, for 6 days, they're to march around the city of Jericho one time. On the seventh day, march around the city 7 times and blow your trumpets and shout and the walls will fall down. Everybody from Vacation Bible School knows that story. And why did the Lord deliver Jericho into their hands in that way? I think it was to show them who was really doing the fighting, who's doing the battle, that the Lord had really already given it to them, but this was going to be a test. It wasn't really a battle. It was a test to see if they really believed God and trusted Him fully. Who would, you know, without trusting God, who in the world would fight a battle that way? You know, we're going to take a whole week here, and instead of, you know, building catapults and trying to breach the wall and preparing ourselves for battle, we're just going to march around the city. And we're going to do it once a day until the seventh day. And then we're going to blow trumpets and march 7 times. Is that a battle strategy? Well, it was for the people who were willing to see that the Lord had already given the city into their hands. And they passed the test, if you know the story of Joshua 6 and 7, and you know the, or Joshua, yeah, 6, and know the Battle of Jericho. However, when you get to Judges, the same kind of language is used again. I've already given the land into your hands. This is a test. Later on in chapter 2, verse 22, it says that the Lord had left these nations there for Israel to fight them in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not. And then again in chapter 3, verse 1, the same thing is said. These are the nations that the Lord left to test Israel by them. So don't read the book of Judges and think that you're reading actual battles. Look at this as tests. These people were still there, and Israel still had battles to fight because they were being tested by the Lord to see if there was anything to their faithfulness at all. There is a comparison to our life here. You know, why is it that instead of just being taken straight to heaven and living in this paradise with God, why are we here in an earth that is full of pain and sorrow and even sickness and death? Why are we in a place like this? And the answer to it is, among other things, we are here to be tested. This was a theory. It's a biblical truth, but it was a theory worked up on his own by a poet named John Keats. Keats was an English poet, and if you studied him at all in high school or college, you learned that, you know, he had a very short life. He was sick with tuberculosis, I think. I'm not exactly sure. But he knew that he wasn't going to live very long. And so most of his adult life, which was very short, was spent trying to deal with the fact that he wasn't going to live very long. He was faced with his own mortality, unlike many young men, not to mention he had this amazing intellect. And he wrote this letter to his brother George, who moved to America. And in this letter, he was working out this theory that he had about life. And he had this idea that life was a veil for soul making. There was a reason for the disease and the pain that we were going through. He saw the raw material of a soul as an intelligence. That's the name that he gave it. But he said it was on its, an intelligence was not fully a soul. It was on its way to becoming a soul. All humans have an intelligence, but they're not considered souls until they develop what he called an individual identity. Now, in order to do that, the soul creation took many years, and it required two components. It needed the human heart, and then it needed a world of feverish suffering. So this was a process that Keats likened to an education. Listen to what he said. He said, "Do you not see how necessary a world of pains and troubles is to school an intelligence and make it a soul? A place where the heart must feel and suffer in a thousand diverse ways." I believe that he stumbled upon something very true, and something that's biblical, and something that, you know, Christians need to take into account when struggling with suffering in this world. This world is like a schoolroom for eternity. It's the seed time of eternity. And what we do in this present life determines our destiny afterwards. This battle we're fighting in life today, which is, you know, can come with joy and peace and love, but is always accompanied by sorrow and pain as well. This is a test that we're in, and the test has a purpose. It's not something that's senseless and has no reason for it. It has a very important purpose of soul making, of developing us for eternity, educating us and preparing us for that time. So, you know, Israel needed to be prepared to be God's holy nation. So they were fighting their battle. We fight our battles for similar reasons. We're being tested. So how does it work out? That's what chapter 1 is all about, the rest of it. You know, you see one battle after another. And as you read, you see a disturbing pattern surface. At first, you know, Judah steps forward, and along with Simeon, those two tribes fight the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and they find a degree of success. But if you continue to read and you get to verse 19, you learn that the Lord was with Judah, and Judah took possession of the hill country, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. Now, if you know the book of Joshua, you know those walls of Jericho couldn't stand against the Israelites just marching around. So what good would chariots of iron be if the people really believed? So there's a disturbing detail there, and you see this pattern continue. Benjamin goes up against the Jebusites, has some success, but they did not drive them out who lived in Jerusalem. So like I said, this isn't the Israel you see under David. David was the one that finally conquered the Jebusites in Jerusalem. Benjamin couldn't rout them out of the city. Joseph went up against the Canaanites. These are the two tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Jacob's son Joseph had a double inheritance, and so two tribes came from his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Some would count them as, two tribes. And they, you know, had some success, but they didn't drive the Canaanites fully out. Verse 28 tells us that they put some of them into forced labor. Others followed suit. Zebulun turned Canaanites into slaves. And then Asher couldn't drive them out. Naphtali couldn't drive them out. Dan couldn't drive the Amorites out. So you start to see this incompletion that, you know, really began in the second half of the book of Joshua, and now it's escalating more and more. You see one failure after another to fully drive them out. They were somewhat successful. They were able to live as neighbors with these people, but they were there with them, and as long as they were, the people were a threat to their faith as they influenced them and, of course, you know, were a danger to them as well. Now, there's one exception if you want to back up in chapter 1 to a little, preview of the first judge that we'll talk about next week, Othniel. Othniel was Caleb's younger brother, and he may have been a brother to Caleb, or maybe been the younger brother of Caleb, but he was still, you know, a generation older than everybody else. And Othniel captured this place, Kiriath Sefer, also called Debir. Caleb had said that the person who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it would receive Aksa, his daughter, for a wife. And it was his little brother who came up against this place and defeated it and received Caleb's daughter, which, I mean, was his niece. I don't think that was as big a deal then as it was today. It's kind of weird to think about. But he received her as his wife, and you could see his faith as he was, you know, willing to take on the people that God wanted to drive out. But for the most part, there was a lack of success, no completion in the test that God had put before them. Now we come to chapter 2, and this is where everything goes off the rails. Chapter 2 begins with the appearance of this character that we'll come to again and discuss more a little later, the angel of the Lord. Now, this is one of the most mysterious characters in the Old Testament, one of the most interesting. I think probably the first place he appears, and here he's not referred to as the angel of the Lord, is in Genesis chapter 18, where these three angels visit the tents of Abraham. And if you remember that story, two of the angels go down to Sodom because the Lord is about to destroy Sodom, and they go down to Sodom to get Lot and his family, while one remains with Abraham to tell him the Lord's plans. So suddenly, after these two of the three angels go down to Sodom, the third angel begins speaking as the Lord. And the personal name for God, Yahweh, is used to refer to this character, the angel of the Lord. This may be the same angel of the Lord that we're introduced to in Judges chapter 2, verse 1. And there's all kinds of speculation about who this is, and I have to say, before I give, you know, any theories about it, that nobody knows for certain who the angel of the Lord truly is. However, God is presented in the Bible as three persons in one divine essence. So you have the Father, the Son, Jesus, and the Holy Spirit. And, you know, we see the Father working all through the Old Testament. Even the Spirit is mentioned in the first couple of verses of Genesis and in other places as well, in particular with a reference to the Word, you know, being spoken by prophets. Where is Jesus? You know, he is eternal just as Father and Spirit. He's just as much a part of the one God as they are. Where is that personality? He has not yet been born of a woman, but he in his essence still exists. And Paul writes about that in Philippians 2, 5 through 8, that he existed in the form of God. So he had to have been doing something at the same time. Why could he not be the angel of the Lord? I mean, you know, he wasn't Jesus just yet. He wasn't 100% human, 100% divine. He was strictly 100% divine at this point. But he existed in a different form. And I'm using the language of Philippians 2 here when I use the term morphe, form. That changed to human and divine at the point of his birth. So, you know, I like to think of this possibly as the Son, the second person of the Godhead, who would become Jesus of Nazareth, who remains Jesus as mediator between God and man, 1 Timothy 2, verse 5. But we don't know for sure. We just know this is an important character, and the name Yahweh is not used in connection with him here, although he will be used. It will be used in connection with him later on in the book of Judges. He appears, he comes up from Gilgal to Bochim. Bochim is the name of this place, and the name probably came from the events that we're about to read about, because Bochim means weepers. And you'll understand the weeping in just a moment. This angel says, and notice he is speaking as the Lord, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare to you. As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. So there is, you know, this dark foreboding that comes over the scene. And as we continue, we read that Joshua dismisses the people. So it seems like we've backed up in time here, and Joshua is a part of this meeting. But Joshua, he dismisses them. They each go to their inheritance. They go about life as usual, and they start this pattern that we talked about as we introduced the book. Verse 7 says, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. And all that generation also, so the first generation that conquered the Promised Land, all of them were also gathered to their fathers. Now look at the last part of verse 10. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the words or the work that he had done for Israel. Now, can you imagine that? One generation later, the children of the people who marched around Jericho, saw the walls fall down, saw Israel win one impossible battle after another, saw all of these miracles, who crossed the Jordan River on dry ground, the children and the grandchildren of these very parents and grandparents did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. Can you imagine that? I mean, how is that possible? But it's exactly what's going on here. These parents did not teach their children about God. They didn't take time to do it. Maybe they were too busy. Maybe they began to get the idea that they were the ones responsible for winning all these battles and settling this land. It's hard for me to think about. But if you start going through your mind, you can think of examples of parents who don't teach their children about the Lord, don't take seriously those impressionable years, you know, don't take them to church, don't take them to class. And so when their kids get older, they don't know God. And then the parents start worrying. What did we do wrong? You know, what could we do different? And by then it's too late. And it was too late here, as we look at the book of Judges. Not that God has given up on them. When you start getting into verse 11, you see a summary of the book of Judges. And this summary explains this cycle that we were talking about at the beginning of the episode. The people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served Baals. And that was the God of the Canaanites. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth being the consort of Baal, you know, another idol, false god. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them, yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, and they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them, and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. So here's the cycle. You know, I could summarize it this way. It starts with sin, usually idolatry and all the things that accompany it, and then oppression. The Lord, you know, backs up, delivers them into the hands of their enemies. They're subjected to death, slavery, battle, all of those horrible things, oppression. Then in oppression, they become so miserable that they realize the error of their ways and begin to cry out to God in repentance. God, moved with pity, hears their groaning and raises up this deliverer or judge who leads them to victory because of the power of God. So he brings them back to a place of peace. And during the lifetime of that judge, the leadership and the faithfulness of the judge, they're fine. But after the judge dies, they forget, you know, their deliverance and go back to their evil ways, and the cycle repeats. So it's sin, oppression, repentance, deliverance, sin, over and over again. And the story is told in seven of those cycles. But here's something I didn't say at the beginning that's very important. You may have noticed in verse 19 that each time they were more corrupt than their fathers. Each time it got worse. So instead of just picturing seven equal cycles, think of a downward spiral. Each time getting worse and worse and worse. Why, you know, why was it like this? Why couldn't it at least have been the same? Why did it continue to get worse? By the way, it did get worse, and that's why as you read through, you see, you know, examples of judges who seemed really good, like Othniel is a good example. Deborah, of course, is a great example. You get to Gideon, and there's some things about Gideon, you're scratching your head, you're thinking, you know, why did Gideon behave this way? Jephthah, you know, makes this awful vow that affects his daughter. And then Samson, there are all kinds of things about Samson that make us scratch our heads. And then when you get to the end of the book, it's just some of the worst stuff that you can read in the Bible that God's people are doing. So the book illustrates this downward spiral. Why did the cycles go downward? There's a pretty simple explanation for that. The reason for the cycles is that the deliverance never had that extra step where the people expressed gratitude in worship to God and had rituals and practices to remember God. And so because they never recognized His grace towards them, the attitudes and the practices necessary for faithfulness never developed in their hearts. And, you know, that's another really important lesson for Christians to learn. There's nothing that motivates us, nothing is going to motivate us and keep us faithful and keep our children faithful, but this kind of gratitude, faithfulness, and remembrance over the grace of God. Nothing motivates us better than God's grace. So Paul writes this in Titus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age. Did you catch what he said about grace? The grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all people, and it trains us. It's supposed to teach us something. It's not going to leave us right where we are, but it's supposed to teach us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions and to live in a certain way, self-controlled, upright, godly, in the present age. This is something that wasn't done in Israel. It's not done now in a lot of places. And whenever the cycle isn't completed with gratitude and remembrance, you go back to where you were. You actually go back to a worse place than where you were. That's why things like, you know, the Lord's Supper does not need to be taken for granted. We take the Lord's Supper on the first day of every week, as the early Christians did, so that we'll never forget Jesus' death for us and the forgiveness of sins that comes from that death. You know, we may think, well, what's the big deal? You know, why don't we take it every month, every quarter, once a year? Why do we have to take it every year? It's a big hassle. And, you know, soon we forget to take it, and then we forget what it symbolizes. And then when we forget that, we just have this empty, hollow structure of religion that is meaningless, and soon it'll be lost as well. So that sets us up, I think, for the first judge that we'll get to in the next episode. Before I go, I need to bring to your attention the key verse of this passage and how important it is. Judges is actually in two places, chapter 17, verse 6, and it's also the last verse in the book. And the key verse is, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. You know, the book of Judges is basically an illustration of Proverbs 14, verse 12. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is the way to death. There's a way that seems right to us, but the end of that way that seems right in our own eyes is death. You know, the Judges illustrates that time and time and time again. In Dostoevsky's book, Crime and Punishment, there's the main character, Raskolnikov, who's the one guilty of murder and he's trying to cover it up. He's the crime part and also the punishment part. But he has this friend who's a lovable character. The book needs, you know, some kind of comic relief, and this guy is the lovable character in the book, the comic relief. I don't exactly know how to say his name. Razumihin, I think, is how you say it. But, you know, he's reasoning through some things, and he says this at one part in the book. He said, "This is man's privilege over all creation." He says, "Through error, you come to the truth." He says, "I am a man because I err. You never reach any truth without making 14 mistakes and very likely 114. And then he says, "And a fine thing too in its way, but we can't even make mistakes on our own account." He says, "Talk nonsense, but talk your own." And then he says this, "To go wrong in one's own way is better to go right in someone else's." I don't agree with that statement at all. To go wrong in one's own way is better than to go right in someone else's. That's probably what the people of Israel thought in the days of the judges. Every man thought did what was right in his own eyes. You know, I may make a mistake, but I'll learn from it and I'll get better. And it's better that I go wrong in my own way than to do what somebody else says, including Joshua or this judge or the angel of the Lord or the law of Moses. And what happened is they got worse and worse and worse. There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end of it is the way of death. That's it till next time.